This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we bring you stories about economic development initiatives in Harlan County, Kentucky, and in Wise County, Virginia. And from the Ohio Valley Resource, we'll learn about innovative approaches to addressing the addiction crisis in our region. That's where we'll start. Aaron Payne has the story.
For years, the Ohio Valley has been known for having some of the highest rates of fatal drug overdoses in the nation. Now, a nonprofit group is trying to shift the focus toward the region's innovative solutions to the addiction crisis. Aaron Payne reports on programs using collaboration to expand addiction treatment and recovery.
The Addiction Policy Forum celebrated solutions at events across the Ohio Valley to honor programs selected in their Innovations to Address Addiction reports. The group's executive vice president for community engagement, Kimberly Clamp, says the 37 programs selected look beyond the traditional methods of addressing addiction.
This is a disease that begins in adolescence and can remain with us the rest of our lives. To think that it could be magically cured in 4 weeks is a myth.
The Addiction Policy Forum is a national nonprofit organization focused on eliminating addiction as a major health problem. Clamp says the innovative programs also align with their goals of helping patients, improving treatment, and educating the public about addiction.
Using the science that we know about the brain disease of addiction, 50% of our country still doesn't believe that addiction is a brain disease.
After years of leading the nation in overdose death rates, Clamp says the Ohio Valley needs new ways to think about the addiction crisis. Those working the programs, the forum highlights, say it's time to focus on solutions that are forward-thinking, collaborative, and can be recreated in other communities in order to combat the crisis. All of the programs in the reports exemplify this model. One out of Huntington, West Virginia, applies it to nearly every aspect of the treatment and recovery process.
Down that hallway are the group rooms, and over here is the nursing station.
The building Michael Haney walks me through is an old CVS that's been transformed into a one-stop shop for those needing help with addiction. Haney is the executive director of PROACT, an outpatient treatment center that aims to guide patients from diagnosis all the way through recovery.
We have one mission, addiction work, but we focus on addiction work as the whole person.
PROACT is a collaborative effort. The main partnership links Valley Health, a health center program that serves the Ohio Valley, and Marshall Health, which operates through Marshall University. The combined resources allow people to come in right when they decide to seek help.
We wanted to set competition aside to actually do something meaningful together because there's some things Valley Health can do, Marshall Health can't. Some things Marshall Health can do, Valley Health can't.
And with the help of other local partners under the PROACT umbrella, a patient can also have housing, transportation, employment, and spiritual needs addressed. This collaborative effort allows them to see nearly 500 patients a week. PROACT also works to eliminate the stigma surrounding addiction through community and patient education.
Healthcare should always be about informed consent. And so if they're informed, they can then decide what they want to do.
Haney says being recognized by the Addiction Policy Forum as an innovative program is gratifying. He thinks their model could help people struggling with addiction in other communities.
We want to be the best, and we hope that through the example of collaboration, others become even better than us.
PROACT is just one of the 37 programs honored by the Addiction Policy Forum as innovative, but it's a great example of the sort of innovation the region needs. Kimberly Clamp says the Ohio Valley's addiction crisis needs more than one solution and communities working together.
We feel like it takes everybody to come together to solve the opioid and addiction crisis. No crisis has ever been solved by just one sector.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Aaron Payne.
Next, from our friends over at WEKU, we bring you Tom Martin's recent interview with Harlan County's Robert Guype. Guype talks economic revitalization in Harlan County in this interview, which originally aired on Eastern Standard.
I'm talking with Robert Guype of Harlan, Kentucky, author and illustrator of the novels Trampoline and Weed Eater. Robert also is executive producer at Higher Ground, a community arts organization based in Harlan County. and he is Design Education Coordinator for its latest project, the Southeast Kentucky Revitalization Project. So a man with a lot of things on his plate, and it's that last role, revitalization, that we want to talk about today. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Southeast Kentucky Revitalization Project. What is it, where is it, and what does it aim to accomplish?
The Southeast Kentucky Revitalization Project is a project of Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College, which serves Letcher Bell and Harlan and Knox counties in Southeast Kentucky. And it kind of grew out of, as a part of our theater work with Higher Ground, we had begun performing around the county and had gotten involved with creative placemaking. We got involved with the Revitalization Project through our work with community theater, through Higher Ground. That project, which uses local stories and local music to talk about what's going on in the community, as a part of that work, we had started performing around the county and had gotten involved with thinking about renovating downtowns, and in particular a couple core buildings in a couple different downtowns. And that got us involved with some local community foundations and some, you know, city governments and such. And so we were looking for a way to get some buildings renovated. And through the Appalachian Regional Commission, which is a federal agency, and the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, and in particular the Appalachian Impact Fund, we developed a proposal that we hoped would kill two birds with one stone. One of them was to help us get some buildings in the area renovated. And the other was to do workforce development around some core skills that would make it easier for economic development and downtown redevelopment to happen in Southeast Kentucky. And so what we came up with was a three-pronged approach. And the first part was, if in the renovation of commercial buildings, because there's been very little of that as a market for contractors in our area, there were not a lot of locally based commercial roofers, mold and asbestos mitigators, some of the kind of heritage construction trades like working with vintage brick buildings. And so when we did get resources to renovate buildings, that business was going somewhere else. We were having to bring in contractors from the Bluegrass or from Knoxville. So with our construction training, we wanted to renovate some buildings but turn them into training exercises. Right now, the biggest part of that was training in commercial roofing. And so we're doing two big projects right now, a commercial building in downtown Cumberland and a commercial building in downtown Harlan, and have been training workers to re-roof those buildings.
This is paid training, right?
Correct. So they're paid a training wage because essentially our idea was to work with local contractors, and we hated for them to lose work while they were training, and so we structured it to be a training that paid people a training wage or a stipend. They're not technically employees. They were just subsidizing their time while they train. We've done some asbestos mitigation training. One of the other components of the project is we had been working with various kinds of visual artists who had gotten involved with doing murals in communities around the region. And there was some concern about people not knowing all they needed to know to make durable, effective murals. And so we started a training for visual artists who might not be in the mural business, but of course that's both a nice art form, and it's something that's a vital part of showing investors that a downtown is taking care of itself, is concerned with its aesthetics. And so our trainings for visual artists surface the need for, when you paint on the side of a brick building, a lot of times those buildings, the mortars eroded, and so we started doing tuck point trainings. And anyway, so the thing is that all of these trainings are designed both to increase the capacity of our local workforce, to create a network between people who are interested in downtown renovation and construction trades, and also to actually result in downtowns that look like they're ready for investment and buildings that are ready for investment.
So it's actually a three-legged stool. So you have construction, you have your design, but also hospitality. Why is hospitality a part of the picture?
I think that our goal for the overall project was both to do workforce training and make people more employable, but also in designing the project, we took a good hard look at what are the skill sets that are lacking in the workforce that make it more difficult for businesses to succeed. And so having a ready pool of people ready to work in the hospitality industry, we felt like some of that training was needed. And so, again, we've targeted our marketing at current employers, people who might have a restaurant, who might not really have a training program for their employees or access to a training for their employees. And so in that part of the program, we've been working with restaurateurs and people in the hospitality industry in terms of lodging and such, just really to try and figure out how to have a workforce that's more ready both to work and also to help businesses in Eastern Kentucky thrive.
There is a thriving Appalachian food movement. And I'm wondering, do you see a convergence here between what's happening there, interest in local foods, and revitalizing downtowns to accommodate restaurants and make it more interesting?
Yeah, I think that even in our trainings, we're trying to work with local businesses. And I think that, I mean, I know personally I have been involved with the Appalachian Food Summit, and so have some of our other staff. And, you know, there's a lot of crossover between these things with Higher Ground. We just completed a contract to do a play about food and labor, which we performed for the Southern Foodways Alliance Conference in Oxford, Mississippi. And then we just did it as a part of a fundraiser for the Appalachian Food Summit, did an event in Corbin with the Wrigley Tap Room, which is one of our great local restaurants that's doing some farm-to-table stuff. And I definitely think that that's all part of the thinking is that, I mean, we're glad to train people for whatever, but I think that our priority is on helping people who are interested in being entrepreneurs or who are already entrepreneurs in the region to be better able to succeed. And so from that point, I mean, and I think also, you know, most of the larger corporate hospitality entities, the hotels and the chain restaurants, they already have training programs. So I think that our market for that training is more with local entrepreneurs who are maybe less set up to do that kind of training.
It's no secret that there's been concern for quite some time about so-called out-migration, brain drain is another way of putting it, losing our young people. Are these efforts aimed at reversing that trend, perhaps?
I know that this is my orientation, and different people in these kind of projects have different, you know, places they come from in it. But I feel like if places are good places to live, they become good places to visit. I think that, you know, I think that as people get more sophisticated in what it's going to take to rebuild the economies of some of the coalfield towns, it's that employers have a lot more options about where they go. And the quality of life in a community is ever more critical to recruiting new employers or to retaining employers. I mean, my sense of it is that if there were work in our communities, that people come back. And also, if these communities are tending to what it takes to make places fun to live in or, you know, safe to live in or just give you a good quality of life. And so, I mean, we know that from at the college when we have new jobs. The people come and apply. It's like there are a lot of people who wouldn't mind living in Eastern Kentucky. A lot of them are people who have grown up here or who have relationships with people there who wouldn't mind coming back if they had a good, stable job. And so a project like ours only is effective in the context of a lot of other things going on. And I think that, you know, one of the exciting things is we're not quite there yet, but we've got a lot of people working cross-sector to kind of think about what it's going to take and what we need to do to make our communities places that people want to be and are able to be.
When you step back and think about the region's future, what do you see?
I think we've got a lot of hard work ahead of us. I think that it's going to take governmental participation at the state, local, and federal level. I think ultimately we've got to be thinking about what do private businesses need to succeed. We got to think about, I really do think that we underestimate the importance of the quality of life to bringing in new businesses and making people want to stay. I think we all, because of the internet and because of transportation systems, we all have things that we enjoy that make life important in terms of recreation and the arts, and that really those kinds of things which in the past have seen as either such a sideshow or even counterproductive to what industry wanted in our communities. I hope we figured out that the cultural aspects of living in a community have a ripple effect in terms of restaurants and activities and things to do, that if we would tend to that, I think we're going to be a lot more attractive to employers, both who are there and who might come to us. And I think that, you know, it's possible. There are a lot of people talking about it. There are a lot of people who are getting it and are starting things. And I think that so much of what we're doing in the nonprofit sector these days in Eastern Kentucky is about enabling the private sector, enabling people to start business and keep businesses going. I would think that it has a lot of bipartisan appeal, you know, that this is just something that makes sense for taking care of people and taking care of places, so that, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic if we keep our eye on the ball and if people keep looking for ways to collaborate instead of to compete or to, you know, not be with one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to be interesting to follow, and we'd like to follow it through your eyes, among others. So always feel welcome here at Eastern Standard to update us. And I have to ask, are you also working on a new novel?
Yes. The manuscript is due March 2020 to my publisher. It's actually finishing a trilogy of a family that's based in a coalfield Eastern Kentucky community. And actually, a lot of the issues that we talked about, they're dealing with, they've been a family that's experienced a lot of mayhem and been the cause of some mayhem themselves. But now they're trying to get Airbnbs going, and one of them's wanting to be a chef and is making soda pop, making out of local wild crafts, and they're getting in the travel magazines. And we had a feature film shot in Harlan County a year or so ago based on Carter Sickles, a EKU faculty member's novel, The Evening Hour, and I was around that a lot. So the phenomenon of how our community's been very good. We've had a couple of feature films shot in Harlan County, and we really enjoyed that. And so, but just thinking about that phenomenon as part of economic development, looking at what happens when the world comes to a place like ours. And so, but then there's, you know, sometimes the old world and the new world collide, and so it's about that.
Do you have a title for it yet?
It's called Pop.
Okay. Illustrated? Are you illustrating?
Yes, sir.
Oh, great. Can't wait for that. So when do you think that'll come out?
So it's scheduled to come out in spring of 2021.
All right. We'll watch for it. Robert Guype, executive producer at Higher Ground, a community arts organization in Harlan County. And he is also design education coordinator for its latest project, the Southeast Kentucky Revitalization Project. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Like in many communities in the mountains, Pound, Virginia is hard at work building a new economy after the decline of coal. In the first installment of a series on economic development in Pound, Sydney Bowles talks to Appleshop's own Marley Green. Green lives in Pound and is involved in the economic development work there.
Across our region, communities are figuring out how to revive economies that have been hurt by the decline in coal. So here at WMMT, we're proud to present a series of interviews about how one town, Pound, Virginia, is moving forward. In our first interview, I speak with community development worker Marley Green. So Marley Green.
That's my name.
Tell me about who you are and what you do.
Okay. So my name's Marley Green, and I am a community development worker here for Appleshop. And so a lot of what I do is to work with community partners around Ledger County, Eastern Kentucky, and then also Southwest Virginia on a variety of community economic development issues. And so in Whitesburg, I've worked on walking trail extension and am helping with a downtown revitalization project that includes a number of stakeholders. And so I also get to work with folks in Pound on community economic development initiatives.
What's the process been of your work in Pound? How did you get started? Why Pound? And what's been coming out of those meetings that you've been having?
Sure. So I think there's a few different threads. I moved to Pound a number of years ago before I started working at Apple Shop, in part just because I fell in love with the town and with the history and with the Pine Mountain Trail and the Pound Lake that's all right there, and it's just a really beautiful spot. And because it's close to Whitesburg, and I like some of what's going on in Whitesburg culturally and artistically. But I really like the town of Pound, and I moved there a few years ago and got to talking with folks in Pound who were trying to improve things. I think Pound, like a lot of little towns around here, has been hit really hard by the decline in the coal industry in the last, you know, 10, 20, 40 years. But especially the last 10 years, I think there's just been a huge loss to the economic base of Pound and a lot of towns in our listening area and are in this area. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of people that care very deeply about the future of Pound and making it a place that, you know, people want to return to who've left to make a living elsewhere, and a place where hopefully young folks can stay. You know, I think a lot of this is just being driven by what can we do to make, you know, the future a better place to be for people in Pound. But a few years ago, before I started working with Apple Shop, we kind of did a brainstorming session. We did a number of interviews with people around town to ask, like, what do you think are the good things about Pound that we could build on and could, you know, use as a springboard for new economic or just, you know, community things in Pound? And a thing that kept coming up was the way it's, you know, it's right up against Pine Mountain, and it's a place that people came to and then sort of were stopped by the mountain for a long time. So it was just a long history of of interesting things. And then also there's a number of legends and sort of, you know, more dramatic history, you know, myths and legends about like Devil John Wright and the Red Fox and these sort of like larger than life stories that have come out of Pound that people think is sort of unique. And, you know, and then of course the hiking trail on Pine Mountain and the lake were another thing that people said, you know, we could really build on this.
What has that process been like so far?
Well, so it's been a lot of listening and a lot of sort of throwing ideas on the wall and seeing what sticks. But I was invited to join the Economic Development Authority of Pound almost two years ago, and that's just a volunteer group established by the town council, but you know, it's a volunteer group of folks just trying to figure out what we can do. And so partnership between the EDA and Pound and the Pound Historical Society and Apple Shop, a year ago we started doing the Red Fox Storytelling Festival. So that's one sort of event that we've started, and part of that is just getting people together and sort of celebrating and telling some of the classic stories about the Red Fox and Devil John Wright, and now Edith Maxwell, who was a young woman in the 30s who became sort of nationally famous for killing her drunken father, alcoholic abusive father. But storytelling as a thing that can draw people together, draw people from outside to Pound. And then we've also worked with the town of Pound, with the EDA and the Historical Society and a few other groups to put in grant applications based on project ideas that have come up in conversations and in just collaboration and talking with each other. So we put in a grant application earlier this year for a series of storytelling events, and then also murals that tell the story of the history of Pound that we would put around town.
I am not from here. I moved here a little over a year ago. And one of the things that I've been really interested in, like, as someone who's not from here and is just, like, trying to figure out what my new home is all about, I've been really interested in, like, all these different theories that people have for what's next. You know, I feel like in a lot of ways we're all just invested in figuring out what's next. And it's really kind of a cool moment for that, I think. But there are a lot of really different ideas. So I wonder, like, how do you feel like your idea or the idea for this kind of development that you've come to with people in Pound is maybe leading to different ideas than other kinds of development might?
The alternative to economic development that's been pursued around here and all over the country, really, for a long time, is like, let's get a big employer here. Let's get a warehouse or a manufacturer, small manufacturer facility that'll employ 20 or 100 people. And what that often looks like is, let's build an industrial park, and the county or the city pays for that industrial park, and they run sewer lines and they run power lines and roads and everything else up to make that. And then there's a big building, and maybe an employer does come in, and it can make a really big difference when an employer like that comes to town, but it also makes a huge difference if they leave. And I think one thing that we're trying to promote is a strategy that says, let's build slow, let's build something that really comes from people that are here and rooted here so that it can last over time and build on itself over time. I don't think storytelling is going to turn around the economy in Pound, right? And I don't think a mural is going to, you know, save blighted buildings. And but I do think employing local artists, getting people talking to each other, seeing small changes. One phrase that keeps coming up is, it's amazing what a coat of paint can do, just for people's sense of what is possible and what is coming down the pike, and if we work together, what we can build.
For people who are listening to this and are interested in starting similar things in their own community, or have come up with interesting thoughts that they might want to carry into their own communities, what suggestions do you have? What can people do to start thinking about this for their own towns?
I mean, I would say, talk to your neighbors. I mean, what a very basic line, share your ideas with your neighbors, share your ideas with, town councils, with economic development, authorities. write it down, put a business plan together. Write it down what your vision is, what your idea is, and share that with somebody that's working on this, whether it's at a nonprofit like Apple Shop or a town council member or, a person working in an economic development authority or something similar.
Marley Green, thank you so much for hanging out and talking with me about this.
Definitely. Thanks for chatting with us.
That was Marley Green, community development worker at Apple Shop and a member of the Pound Economic Development Authority. This interview is part of a series on Pound, so tune back in next time to hear more about how one community in the mountains is moving forward. I'm Sydney Bowles, and you're listening to Mountain News on WMMT.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org, or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. Music on this episode features Pigmeat Jarrett with a tune called The Walking Blues. That song is included in his album Look at the People, which was released by Apple Shop's own June Apple Recordings in 1979. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.